From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're one of the hundreds of millions of people around the world who plays games, online, video, computer, Jane McGonigal has a message of reassurance. You have not been wasting your time. All of that time spent staring at a screen with your thumbs working away is time, she says, where you've been building up a wealth of virtual experience that can change the world. The idea is to use the particular gifts of gamers. Urgent optimism is one. So is productivity and cooperation on an epic scale. And McGonigal says you take that and tackle real-world problems. Climate change, poverty, mental illness, and, of course, education. We're finishing up our series of conversations today about the future of higher ed. Jane McGonigal is with us to talk about how you use games to fix reality. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So I promise it's not a stretch to wrap up a week of programs about the future of higher education with a conversation about games. Much of the conversation has been about how technology is going to influence higher ed in the coming years, whether traditional institutions will adapt to the challenges and the opportunities of technology. This is where games come in. Online games are one of the most functional uses of technology. And there are millions, hundreds of millions of gamers on the planet. For the last few years, Jane McGonigal has been making a provocative case. She's a gamer herself, a prominent game designer, who wrote a very popular book a few years ago explaining how games can change the world. Right now, people spend more than 3 billion hours a week gaming, and she says they should spend even more, a lot more. McGonigal says gamers have certain gifts, and she's not talking about hand-eye coordination and spatial intelligence and map-reading skills. She's talking about the skills you get when you have to work with thousands and thousands of partners to ward off dragons or capture a golden shield or whatever. It's collaboration that comes along with ambition and optimism and, yes, productivity. Today in the program, Jane McGonigal is with us to talk about her vision for the future, where games are used to fix real-world problems, poverty, climate change, and declining education. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jane McGonigal is, as I said, a game designer, a future forecaster, the author of the book I mentioned. It's called Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. And she's joining us today. She's been a guest of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum. She spoke earlier today at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. And Jane McGonigal, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
So I guess I wanted to begin, go back a bit to 2001. And you explained this in your book, where you had just sort of started your career. You were working on what you call the fringes of the game design industry, some of these small startups, experimental labs. You're studying at Berkeley, getting a PhD in performance studies. What is performance studies?
Performance studies is a mixture of psychology and anthropology and ethnography. You study what people do oftentimes in their real lives, and the kinds of play and performance that figure into it.
Yeah. What interested you about that?
Well, when I was at Berkeley, there was this weird phenomenon starting to bubble up, which is you would see gamers online talking to their fellow gamers, looking for ways to use their skills to solve a real-world problem. Mm-hmm. It was actually my first fall at Berkeley. It was September 2001, and on the day of 9/11, all of these gamers swarmed together and said, you know, we are collective intelligence. We can do collective investigation. What can we do to help figure out what went wrong and what can prevent it in the future? And they debated if this was crazy or not because, well, games are fiction and they're not real problems and we don't have any actual abilities. But wait, we do. And there's no distributed network like us. And this desire to help, but this doubt as to whether they had real skills or abilities.
Yeah. Whether you could translate it.
Exactly. That is what I set out to find out. What are they good at and does it translate to reality?
You say they. Did you mean me? I mean, were you a gamer at the time?
I was a gamer. In fact, I had played the game that that all these players were swarming around trying to figure out if they could reverse engineer Al-Qaeda. and I found it intriguing enough to take it seriously.
Eventually, you became convinced, and this is the essence of your book, that you could in fact translate these gifts into solving real world problems. I wondered, did this come to you gradually, or did you have kind of a moment of revelation based on something that you had seen or heard or had studied?
I think there was a big breakthrough in 2007, so it actually took a while.
Yeah.
The first thing that I wanted to do was figure out just what gamers were good at. And so there are all sorts of things besides, as you mentioned, these sort of cognitive abilities. I think for me, the number one thing I was seeing was the ability to provoke positive emotions, even in the face of a great challenge or even in the face of constant failure. So gamers spend 80% of the time failing, and they don't give up.
Yeah.
A skill like that, that kind of resilience.
I want to break all these down, by the way, as we go, because it's an important part of the book. But you started to see that there were
There were real skills.
Yeah.
And so to try and figure out, what kinds of problems would benefit from the ability to fail often and keep trying, the ability to communicate with other people about strategies you tried that didn't work.
Yeah.
And so for me, the big breakthrough was a project I worked on in 2007 called World Without Oil, where we invited ordinary people to try to figure out how you would survive a peak oil scenario.
Yeah.
And this is a crazy idea. We were going to do a simulation, but normal simulations, we tell you what happens. If you decide to do X, Y will occur. We build algorithms to provide feedback on your choices. We had the players basically build the algorithms. We said, okay, if there's an oil shortage and 30% of employees can't get to the office, how will your company run? And you had to actually fill in the blank and come up with responses that other people might have or that your boss might have or that your industry might have. And to make a long story short, a year later, gas prices in the United States hit our fictional oil prices that we'd started the simulation with.
Wow.
And we were able to go back and validate many of the ideas and strategies that players had come up with. They were either using them in their real lives or the pitfalls and problems they'd forecast actually were happening where experts had failed to predict that they would occur.
Hmm. There's this phenomenon taking place. You quote the economist Edward Castronova, who calls it a mass exodus to game spaces by hundreds of millions of people. And it's interesting, in the book, I can't tell if you think that's a bad thing or a good thing.
That's good, because I think we have to be nuanced about it. I think if we believe games are a distraction from reality, then absolutely it's a problem to have so many people. We're up to 1 billion gamers now, by the way, billion gamers who spend at least an hour a day playing these games. But so if we think it's a distraction, yeah, I think we should be worried about, because it's incredible energy and creativity and time poured into these virtual problems.
Yeah.
But if the research shows that this time we spend in game worlds improves our real world relationships or improves our ability to be optimistic about tough challenges or makes us better collaborators, then we don't have to worry about it as long as we provide springboards back into reality.
Yeah.
Because all the practice in the world doesn't matter if you never get out there and use it.
And
so
actually do it.
We have to build games that provide a bridge from the virtual world to the real world.
Yeah, it's one thing to have the simulator if you're a pilot. You've got to actually fly. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we need gamers to start flying.
if these large swaths of humanity are retreating, and you talk about how it's not the first time, and you write about history a bit in the book, and I wanted to ask you about that, how human gameplay has always been a part of human societies. Explain that, if you would. Talk a little bit about that, because you write about, spend a lot of time with it in the book, but how there were these ancient counting games in Egypt. Were these the same impulses now? I mean, have we always had these kinds of impulses?
Well, the thing that strikes so many people about games and makes them seem kind of scary is how immersive they are. We can start playing a game and hours later we've lost track of time. The world is lost to us. We forgot to eat. And people think that it's the technology that's creating that kind of powerful immersion. But if you go back in history, you find that the very first history written about what games were and why they were invented was exactly that immersive power of games. Herodotus wrote the story about ancient Lydians inventing dice games to distract themselves from a famine. Yeah. He writes that they spent 18 years alternating between playing games on one day and being so immersed in the games that they would not feel hungry and they would forget to eat. And then on the alternate days, they would not play games and they would eat. And that somehow that power of immersion allowed them to survive this great catastrophe. And I find that fascinating because when people think, oh, well, Herodotus, maybe some of his tales were a little bit apocryphal. Yeah. But it certainly shows that even as far back as these ancient kingdoms where the technology was no more sophisticated than sheep's knuckles right. that they were using as dice, that there was a sense that games absorb us mentally and emotionally in a way that no other art form does. They had music, they had theater, they had epic poems, but there was something about games that was more compelling than any other medium.
And they make us resilient, you say. That was an important thing too, it seemed.
They do. The ability to feel motivated and optimistic is, I think, the secret sauce of games. And there's a lot of neuroscience now. We can put gamers in fMRI machines and see exactly what regions of the brain are being motivated. And there's this old saying that the opposite of play isn't work, it's depression. Mm. We can see that neurologically now. The regions of the brain that get lit up are the reward centers that are associated with being highly motivated. They're the, you know, the hippocampus, which we associate with learning new skills and abilities. So this idea that games allow us to stick with hard problems until we get better at them. And that's, you know, as soon as we get really good at a game, most of us stop playing it, by the way. Yeah. Certainly with video games, you get bored. You want the experience of being bad and getting better, that thrill of mastery, that amazing accomplishment. So that's what games are really training us to do. Start out being really bad, don't give up, get better, achieve your goal.
One of the essential points about the book is how people around the world are, as you say, abandoning reality from time to time. And you say the real world is missing. There's something when you're talking about reality that, of course, they're not entirely rejecting it. They have real lives and all those. But for some reason, for people who are gamers, the real world is missing something for them. What is it?
Yeah, this is something that's really hard for people to understand because I don't think there are any gamers who are saying, I love my 3D virtual world. It's so much better than reality. I never need reality. What they're responding to is the cultural constructs that we've built in our schools, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods that make it very difficult for people to experience truly wholehearted engagement with things that are difficult for us, or make it possible for people who are extremely introverted to make meaningful social connections with strangers. Games are allowing us to transcend everyday social constructs. You know, when we talk about education, the fact that failing an exam in the classroom counts in some permanent way towards your grade, towards your ability to get into college, is a crazy social construct that in no way has to exist. Yeah. In games, you can fail a level as many times as you want until you master the skills to get the score needed to go on. And so when we say that, you know, gamers are flocking towards these better engineered environments, it's not because we should just give up on reality. We should say, hey, what if we just changed the way we do testing in classrooms to focus on the actual skills and abilities rather than you have one shot and if you fail, it will permanently affect your ability to get into college. Yeah. It's sort of stress and pressure. It's insane. And there's no way we have – there's no reason why we have to design it that way. Yeah. We could design it more like games and bring the gamers back into that feeling of optimism and wholehearted engagement at real schools, at real workplaces.
Yeah, because that's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
They want to engage.
Absolutely. There's nothing about gaming that's a passive or dropping out. Gamers work really hard to solve problems and to form teams. So they're just more engaged in the games than they are at workplaces that might not tap their strengths or feel like they have an opportunity to see the results of their efforts at the end of the day.
You've probably seen that South Park where the boys have become caught up in that world of Warcraft, right? Have you seen it?
I did see that.
So as the episode goes along, they get fat and pasty and get these blemishes, and they begin to look like these really pathetic slugs. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? Because it seems like this is the sort of cultural bias you write about. Do you think?
And we don't even have to call it a bias. Let's call it a completely reasonable fear and anxiety, because I think any one of us, even I, the first time I played World of Warcraft, hours went by. It's 3 a.m. I had to send my husband to the corner store to get Cheetos for us to have for dinner. I understand. I think we fear that we will get sucked in, right?
Yeah.
And so things like you shouldn't spend more than an hour at a time in a game without standing up and moving around. Like physically, we're still human beings. We have needs for physical activity and face-to-face social interaction. So I think it's fine to have cultural representations of that fear.
Yeah.
But, you know, we can play with it. I recently heard this great example of a mom who there's a payphone that's 1 mile from their house. And if her son wants to play video games, he has to get to the payphone within 8 minutes of leaving the house, call her from it, and then get back, and he can play for 30 minutes. Yeah. And if he wants to play another 30 minutes, he has to run another mile. So this is great. We don't have to choose one or the other. But there are emotional benefits and mental benefits and social benefits to games that we're not going to get in the sort of, you know, just walking around the block. We're going to try and find the best of both.
But this idea that they're all a bunch of pathetic losers.
Well, yeah, isn't that funny? Because, you know, you hear that all the time, but then parents don't really believe that about their kids.
Right.
They worry that it's true. And then you even have in some parts of the world, you know, in South Korea, there actually is the widespread feeling that gamers are losers. When I go there to speak, they act like it's the biggest social problem of their time. They have the highest gaming rates in the world. I go over there and I say, you are perfectly situated to become an incredible, innovative society. But what they do is they tell the kids who've, you know, spent their nights in these real-time strategy games that are building such immense strategic, like, superpowers that they've thrown their lives away. Yeah. They'll never be good for anything. And that's the conversation we need to stop having. We need to stop telling gamers that they've wasted their time, that they'll never get this time back, because gamers will believe that if we say it enough. And it's not true. So societies or families need to find a way to talk about the gaming as time you've put into developing a skill and developing an ability, or even just surviving. I can't tell you how many people use games during intense periods of, you know, whether you're going through a divorce, post-traumatic stress disorder, coming home from serving in the war, children in the hospital who have anxiety about surgery. You can also just use games to get through tough times and heal emotionally from them.
Jane McGonigal is with us. She's author of the New York Times bestselling book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. She gave a presentation earlier today as part of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum. It's presented by the Hinckley Institute of Politics. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, as we finish up our series on the future of higher education, a gamer is joining us. Jane McGonigal designs computer games, and like the billion now, I was going to say hundreds of million, but there's a billion people who actually play. And McGonigal says this play is not wasted time. It doesn't have to be a retreat from reality. Games, she says, fulfill human needs. They inspire engagement and can actually create real happiness in people's lives. Today in the program, we're talking about games and her New York Times bestselling book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wondered if there is there a common characteristic with gamers? If you say, who are gamers, is that a kind of a silly question?
Well, it is in the sense that we know 99% of boys under 18 and 94% of girls under 18 across all ethnic socioeconomic levels in the United States are playing games regularly at least an hour a day.
Wow.
So the new generation, everybody plays. One in four gamers are 50 years old or older in the U.S. It's almost equally split gender. So in that regard, everybody games. And people play for different reasons.
Sure.
So you'll find people who play primarily for stress relief, people who play to connect, you know, with their kids, people who play for mental challenges that they're not getting at school or work.
Or work, yeah.
So different motivations.
It's interesting you talk about how corporate leaders – a majority of corporate leaders, like we're talking CEOs and mm-hmm. CFOs, take game breaks at work.
It's true. And if you ask them why they do it, the number one response they give is they say they do it to feel more productive, which on the face of it sounds ludicrous. but in fact, games do allow you to have that quick focus of your mental efforts. So you get your attention on something, you do it, it's hard, you win, you feel like you got something done. And studies suggest that that actually carries over back into real work. So once you achieve a goal, you're more likely to achieve the next one. The trick is just stop with one in-game goal and then quickly go back to your in-life work. Yeah.
I wonder if are gamers, well, as you said, the younger generation, they're all gamers. But are gamers more likely to be in some way religious or political or particularly idealistic?
That's an interesting question. Nothing that I've seen suggests that yet. We do know that the kinds of games you play do influence your temperament in some ways. For example, people who spend a lot of time playing competitive games do tend to be more competitive in the workplace or with others, right?
Yeah.
People who play what we call pro-social games, where you're primarily helping other characters or spending time in teams working together, tend to spend more time helping others or feel more comfortable asking for help in real life. Now, is one better than the other? I think it depends. If you're trying to cultivate a sense of competitiveness, which could be useful, maybe some people, they're not goal setters or they have low self-esteem, you want them to feel competitive, you could bring that out of them by putting them in a competitive game environment where they have a chance to succeed.
Yeah.
If you want people to be more cooperative and collaborative, more pro-social behavior in real life, co-op games seem to draw that out as well.
I guess the point is that there are all kinds of different games.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things I wondered about is you talk about how gaming should be purposeful, not just escapist, which is not to say there isn't anything wrong with just having something that's escapist. But isn't the point of a game, for some anyway, not to be purposeful? You know, doesn't it for some people ruin a game if it becomes too presumptuous or too high-minded?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're trying to use a game for social change, do people ever talk about that kind of defeats the purpose for them? They're trying to get away from all of that. Does that make sense?
Well, I think there are two ideas here.
Yeah.
First is escapism. So there's been some great psychological research showing that there are two forms of escapist entertainment. One form is good for us and one form isn't. The bad form is when we try to suppress emotions or avoid encounters.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go watch a movie or play a game because I don't want to feel how I'm feeling. I don't want to see who I'm seeing.
Right.
That's not good for us in the long term. But there are other people who use escapist entertainment to inspire themselves, to feel awe and wonder or to get a sense of magic or humor or something that they feel is missing. Mm. Or they escape in order to practice these skills or feel like they're improving an ability, right? That's considered quite positive because it's with an eye towards going back to your real life feeling better, feeling stronger. Mm. So you're not going to avoid reality forever. So what I'm trying to do is encourage gamers to make sure that they're doing the purposeful form of escape,
yeah.
which really you don't have to change your behavior. It's really changing your mindset. Instead of thinking about escaping things you don't like about your life, think about games as giving you better tools to handle them. Now, does having a real-world social purpose ruin the fun of a game?
Yeah.
You know, most people are craving more meaning in their lives, not less meaning. If you ask somebody, would they like a chance to cure cancer? Would they like a chance to, you know, root out corruption in the government? Would they like a chance to start their own business to end hunger in Africa? These are not things that people would say, you know, no, I'd never like to help the world. They just don't feel empowered to do it. So I think the trick with these games is to give everybody a realistic hope of doing something meaningful. If you knew you could be successful and cure cancer, I don't know many people who wouldn't try. And now we actually have games where players are doing this, working alongside real scientists to make breakthroughs. It's incredible.
Well, one of the you have an entire chapter where you talk about how for gamers this idea of working for something bigger than yourself, and you talk about this really sort of epic monumental milestone. I don't have it in front of me. I think it was World of Warcraft where they had
Halo
3,
mm-hmm.
and they had come to a billion
seven
kills,
billion.
7 billion kills, or yeah. something like
of
that.
Aliens.
Of aliens.
Yes.
But talk about why that was so important, because the bigger picture is that, in fact, in some way, and it seems silly to make the connection mm-hmm. to aliens and a real world problem, but you do make some kind of connection that they are – that in that game, they are thinking about something bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is maybe the most controversial thing I said in the whole book. I've heard quite a lot about it, this idea that – gamers around the world banding together to kill 7 billion aliens, which is equal to the number of people on Earth, that would be meaningful in any way. And what I wanted to communicate, and I believe so deeply, is that what experiences like this show, you know, when the Halo players set that as a goal, when they worked together to achieve it, when they celebrated it, what they were saying is we can set our minds to something that sounds impossible and we can work together to achieve it. None of them thought it meant anything, you know, in the real world. It wasn't like they were celebrating in some delusional way an accomplishment. What they were celebrating was I have joined forces with people like me from virtually every country on the planet. And we did something that sounds impossible, and we did it anyway. And we can harness that impulse, that desire to be proud and to join forces globally. And that's exactly what game designers are doing now when they have, you know, games like Fold It to cure disease or games like Evoke to help bring developing countries out of poverty. And these opportunities are now coming into play.
Is it weird being on the defensive about some of these things sometimes? Did you expect that?
Well, of course, because so many of these ideas are counterintuitive.
Yeah.
And I guess I would not mind – I get the label of being optimistic and idealistic, and I guess that's true. In my training as a future forecaster, I specialize in – what we call positive imagination. It's where you look at what's actually going on in the world and try to figure out the best possible outcome so that we know where to put our resources and our time and energy. Other people can look at the worst case scenario outcomes. And mostly with games, that's what we do. It's yeah. the worst possible thing that's going to happen to humanity as a result of games. So I see my job is to say we don't have to resign ourselves to, you know, the game apocalypse, that we can instead think about the benefits and use them intentionally to do good. But, you know, of course there are problems and obstacles, but that's not my job. My job is to say there's a better future we can work towards, and we happen to have a billion people who are perfectly trained to get to that future.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's take some phone calls. Jeffrey is with us in Draper, Utah. Jeffrey, welcome.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I had a question about board games. Personally, myself, I play a lot more board games than I do video games. And in the last few years, there's been a lot of games that have come out that are very deep and complex and a lot of entertaining. And I'm curious if she sees the same thing with board gamers as she does with the video gamers.
That's a great question. I hear that all the time now because the art of board game design has been so elevated in recent years. And I would say absolutely, if you're playing sophisticated games, particularly if they have cooperative elements, my favorite board games would have more of a co-op element. If you look at traditional board games like Monopoly or Scrabble, they're not really that great in terms of providing a challenge that's constantly escalating or creating the social atmosphere where you will like each other more after you play. But board games today can do that. And the main thing that video games do consistently that board games don't is video games can match the level of difficulty to your ability. So imagine if you're a chess player or you're playing Scrabble. It's hard to find opponents that are just a little bit better than you are and constantly always play someone just a little bit better. That's how we grow and learn. Mm. So video games do have an advantage in that department of allowing us to learn faster and grow faster in our abilities. But board games have, you know, the benefit of face-to-face social interaction, which is one of the big payoffs we know about games. So it's a bit of a toss-up. Try to play the more complex cooperative ones if you really are interested in the sort of mental resilience. But the social resilience is there.
It seems like a designer would have to really – you'd have to know a lot about sort of human nature, human psychology. I mean, I'm like, one of the things you write about in the book is the World of Warcraft, how it's this example of how collaboration works and how cooperation works. And an aspect of the World of Warcraft – is that the mission is matched with your ability, that there's not a challenge that you could not achieve. And that's an important aspect of games generally, but this particular game, talk about that.
Well, it's the thing that game designers are most excited about trying to figure out how to translate to the real world, because we have difficulty setting goals in real life. And there's been fascinating research suggesting that depression is linked to having bad goals, that if we set goals that are too high for ourselves, we start to sense that we have no realistic chance of achieving them. We don't have the resources, we don't have the abilities, we don't have the social support, and we sink into a depression, which is meant to draw us out of that goal seeking until we can formulate a better goal. In games, you have a constant stream of goals. It's almost like this, you know, superhero to-do list where as long as you basically put in the time and effort and energy, particularly in these role-playing games. They design it so that if you give it a go, you're not going to fail 100 times. Yeah. You're gonna make progress.
And you always have something to do.
So, you know, people are trying to figure out how do we teach everybody to set this kind of goal in real life. It's the appropriate scope. It's looking at what you have resources for. It's looking for who you have allies, you know, to help you with the goal. And that's – there are so many apps now coming out. People are making, you know, mobile apps for you to improve your life, you know, apps like Lyft or Everest, you know, this idea of climbing any mountain. But you have to have the right skill, the right resources, the right allies at the right time.
Jeffrey, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Jonathan is with us in Provo. Jonathan, hi.
Hi. My question has to do with motivation, the intrinsic motivation to play games. For me, I love to play games a lot of times because I get to choose to do it. You know, I can choose to play one game or another, and if I want to stop playing one game, I can, and that's, you know, that's got a certain amount of motivation. My question is, in these, you know, educational or social-based games, is the fact that the stakes are now raised, that this is something like an education where you need to do this, is there anything to show that people's motivation to play this game decreases because it's more of a real problem rather than just a casual game?
Mm. That's a good question.
You've hit on something really important here, which is absolutely if you remove the element of choice, of free will, the motivation goes away and the engagement worsens. So in any kind of setting, a work environment, a school environment, you have to keep the sense of choice and volunteering to play. And there are different ways you can do it. For example, you could have a number of games to choose from, right? And the student chooses that day which game they're most inspired to play, right? That's absolutely something that has to be there in order for you to keep that same self-motivated spirit. You can also allow people within a game to self-select roles to play. I want to be involved with the problem solving. I want to be involved with the social organization. I want to be involved with the long-term strategy. I want to be involved with communicating what's going on. Allowing people to self-select a role within a game environment can keep some of that, you know, free choice, self-motivated spirit involved if you have a game that you really want to require people to play. One of my favorite topics now, people are looking at games for rehabilitation within the prison system. And what if you, you know, well, the first thing you could do is just offer people the opportunity to play. Yeah. And that would be the first choice. But within the system, to give them more choice about what skill they want to develop or what role they want to play, to really augment that sense of free will is really important. But there's no evidence to suggest that having a real outcome makes participation lower. I don't think that we're afraid of having an impact. I think we just don't like being told what to do.
Yeah. Jonathan, thanks. Back to the phones. Ian is with us in Midvale. Ian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi.
I wanted to bring up the idea of LARPing and other tabletop RPGs as a social skill builder. I'm not sure if your guest has done any research on those, but I'd like to hear her input.
Sure, yeah. LARPing, live-action role-playing. You know, the thing I love best about LARPing are when the players are actually actively participating in designing the world, sort of creating the rules for how the world will work, creating the characters and the dynamics that they will have. As a skill set, that's really intriguing because it allows you to imagine alternatives to the way our ordinary worlds work and how would a social system be designed and how would people, different characters, respond to different kinds of rules and incentives. And there's a lot of obviously beautiful storytelling that goes alongside that. But I definitely think the ability to imagine alternative worlds and then test out your ideas about how that world might work is really quite nice. It's something that future forecasters do all the time. We try to imagine different futures and what reality might be like in those futures. So anyone who is a fan of LARPing might want to consider joining forces with people who are trying to study the future and imagine new governments or new ways to run society.
Ian, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join the conversation. Jane McGonigal is with us. She's the author of the book Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. She's here in Utah as part of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum presented by the Hinckley Institute of Politics. She gave a presentation earlier today as part of the forum. And you can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jane McGonigal. We're talking about her popular book, Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Okay, so we were talking just right there at the break, a game that you created sort of to heal yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken on an interesting life. Talk about that.
Sure. Well, while I was writing this book, I hit my head. I got a concussion. It didn't heal properly. And I went through this really awful time where I couldn't work on the book. I couldn't read or write. I could barely get out of bed. So I couldn't really see people socially. I had a lot of depression and anxiety. And it was so so difficult to imagine myself getting better. I mean, it was definitely the most hopeless I'd ever felt. And yet some part of me was able to think, you know, you're writing this book about games and how they super empower us, they make us optimistic, they make us, you know, better able to ask others for help. Surely you can somehow turn this recovery into a game. And so I just started making up rules for this imaginary game where I would recruit friends and family and they would have missions. You know, my sister would call me every day to give me one thing to do that would get me out of bed, because I was having a hard time physically just getting out of bed.
Yeah.
But, you know, to do one thing, go sit by the window for 5 minutes. And when I call you tonight, I want to hear about something interesting you saw at the window, yeah. You know, and getting this kind of support and thinking about my superpowers and how I was going to battle the concussion symptoms. And
you called it Jane the Concussion Slayer.
I called it Jane the Concussion Slayer, inspired by Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And really just to get, you know, get the dopamine going, get the brain, because the brain, when you have a traumatic brain injury, it literally depresses the brain. And I was trying to use the forces of gaming to help.
Mm-hmm.
So people online, I started posting videos and rule sets. And people online started playing it for all kinds of things, for going through chemotherapy, for trying to lose weight, for post-traumatic stress disorder. And it seemed to be working for them in lots of the same ways. So I wound up doing all this research in a field called post-traumatic growth, where an injury or illness can actually help you build up your strengths, learn to be happier, feel like you have a better sense of meaning and purpose in your life, that your friends and family understand you better. And so I wound up making this game, you know, as an app, online. We've been able to do a clinical trial on it.
Hmm.
There'll be results from a randomized control study with the University of Pennsylvania out this spring. The number one thing we found is that it seems to work best for depression and anxiety, which is a wonderful thing, because there are clinical trials now being done on other games, just normal, casual online games that anybody would play, showing also that it outperforms pharmaceuticals for treating depression and anxiety. So, you know, going back to the start of our conversation, I'm convinced that this emotional resilience that games give us is bleeding into our real lives in really positive ways and allows us to pull ourselves out of depression and anxiety, even in extremely difficult life situations. And I feel like my experience using my gamer powers to go from being suicidally depressed to creating something that could help heal others is a great example of what every gamer has inside them.
It's called Super Better.
It's called Super Better. Yeah. It's free.
Yeah, yeah. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Ed is with us in Salt Lake. Ed, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to throw a cog in the machinery here. I'm a grandparent that's raising a couple of grandkids of my own. I've also raised four boys of my own. I've got a fairly large family. So I've got some data to go through, okay?
Okay.
Those that have played games and that are still playing those games, and to call it a game says something wrong with it to me, and I'm sure there are grandparents that feel the same way I do, have not accomplished as much as those that have put it aside and moved on. I've got a grandkid, like I say now, that's getting D's and F's. If I let him, he'll play a game 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. but he will not do any homework.
Mm-hmm.
It's frustrating. It's totally frustrating. As I say, I have nieces, nephews, sons, daughters, whatnot. Those that have left those games alone at some point in time
mm-hmm.
have moved on. They treated it as such.
Mm-hmm.
Those that stick with it, it's no good.
Well, I'm sure you get this all the time.
Yeah, and it's a very real challenge. There's a part of my book called Practical Advice for Gamers and Parents of Gamers, and there's some very simple things we know from the data. More than 20 hours a week becomes a problem. So right away, if you have someone in your life who's spending more than 3, maybe 4 hours a day gaming, we know that leads to problems in terms of not achieving your life goals or physical problems, health problems, right? So we can start by saying there are limits to this, absolutely. Now, do I believe that gamers should grow up and put away the games for good? Absolutely not. You know, as a grandparent, you hopefully have had the opportunity to experience the incredible joy of playing games with your grandkids. There's been so much research. Brigham Young did amazing research showing how much improved relationships are between parents and their kids when they spend time playing games together, particularly fathers and daughters. The kids get better grades, they're happier, they have better behavior, they're more likely to ask their parents for help with a real world problem. So we don't want to put the games when we grow up. We want to keep playing them, play them with our family, but respect the limits, because the research shows these games improve our skills and abilities, make us more resilient, but that only matters if we take those abilities and powers to real life. And if you just play the game, you have helped no one, you have not helped yourself. So you're absolutely right to say that you have to put down the controller, step away from the computer, but not forever. You know, we're talking about an hour or two a day can continue to help you get stronger and get better and build your relationships. You just have to have something of meaning in your real life. And by the way, that's why I'm trying to redesign schools and healthcare and government and workplaces so that there aren't people who feel like they'd rather spend 24 hours playing a game than showing up at school or the workplace. They only feel that way because there is nothing as compelling or challenging that they feel like they can be successful at in their real lives. That's the only reason why we see that. So we have to create opportunities that they can use their skills and abilities to do successfully.
It's interesting how Ed says he doesn't even like the word game, or at least he has some, you know. Mm-hmm. And you write about this kind of our language. There's a bias against the idea of a game and the word game or player. Do you sometimes wish that you could find another word for all of this?
People ask me that all the time. They say, well, you know what? You've created Super Better. Why are we calling it a game? It's going to help people heal from traumatic brain injuries. You know, let's just call it a system or a method.
Right.
But I feel like there is something powerful to most people about games, and it gets back to that idea of voluntary participation and freedom to play. It's so important. Games give us a freedom to challenge ourselves and to feel like everything we're doing comes from our own sense of motivation and purpose and desires to play and get better. And I think there's real meaning in that word. You know, since we've been human, we have created these artificial challenges for ourselves to come together and try to get better at them. And that's worth keeping as a social construct.
Let's take another call. Jill is with us in Midvale. Jill, hi.
Hi. My question is more about quitting. Earlier in the program, you said that one of the main things about gamers is that they've learned not to quit. They just keep going. But in the real world, we don't have any guarantee that it's possible to win. Mm-hmm. And so when it's hard for me to translate as a gamer into the real world, the loss of that, you know, depression that comes with the fact that it's futile.
Yes.
So do you think there are any games out there that make it so there are challenges that you don't know if you can succeed in, or if it's possible to never accomplish it, would people still try?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm wondering about. I can take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
That's such a great question. So, you know, for example, there are games like Tetris, which are impossible to win. You never win Tetris. Tetris just gets harder and harder and harder until you lose. Somebody did their dissertation on this, proving that it's mathematically, there is no win state for Tetris.
Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting example of, you know, when you're not quitting in Tetris, it's not because you've been guaranteed some kind of successful outcome. You don't quit because you can sense that you're getting better. And that's what we're looking to translate to real life. Giving people that ability to monitor their own performance and progress and put their energy and effort towards areas where they're making progress. You know, I do this in my own life. I'm a runner. And, you know, last year I decided to start training for longer races, do a half marathon. I got my little training schedule and someone told me, you know, if you have what it takes to be a long distance runner, doing this program, you will be able to do it and you will get better. And within, you know, 16 weeks, you'll be able to run a half marathon. Not everybody has exactly the right, you know, physical attributes to be a long distance runner. So you go into it with an open mind.
Yeah.
It worked for me. It wouldn't work for someone else. And I wouldn't want you to keep running, trying to stick to this plan if you're not getting better, making progress. So I think what we're looking for is that awareness am I making progress? It's not a guarantee of a victory, but if you're getting better and you can see that and sense that and measure that, then you will keep going forward.
Thanks very much for the call. You know, let me ask finally, about a minute left. You write about what it's going to take to kind of accomplish, you know, this vision that you have. We talked about doing away with the cultural, you know, bias, those kinds of things. Also building hybrid industries. I mean, it's one of the things you spend some time with in the book. You quote the journalist, I think it's Rob Fahey, who said it's inevitable. Soon we're all going to be gamers. So what do you think the future is going to look like with that in mind? Are you optimistic about all of that?
I'm pretty optimistic that there will be a universal cultural literacy in collaborating together and competing in environments that ask us to tackle absurd obstacles. So there will be a kind of widespread willingness to try to accomplish these large collective goals. And the more energy I see invested in this space by healthcare groups, by government, by education, I do feel optimistic that we will not just be throwing away our lives in virtual worlds, but that we will be using it as a training ground to do real good. It's not inevitable.
Yeah.
We have to make a conscious choice every day to step away from the game and do something that matters in the real world. And as long as we make that choice and help others make that choice, I think we're headed towards a very good future.
Jane McGonigal. Her book is called Reality is Broken, Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. She gave a presentation earlier today as part of the 16th Annual Siciliano Forum presented at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Oh,